Accession number 29054, Mr. Bin Wells, Reel 9. Now, so after the, we'll go back into the chronological thing. After the strike attack on Truk Island on the 15th of June, 44, what happened next?
We returned to a place called Marnus, which was the advance base of the British Pacific Fleet, and it was part of the Admiralty Islands, which are north of New Guinea. It took us about 2 days, I think, to get back to Marnus. There was not just the Implacable, there was our attendant destroyer and two or three cruisers that had joined us to do these strikes on the Truk Islands. And when we got back to Marnus, there was a certain amount of replacement of air crews, replacement of aircraft.
And were they damaged, or why was that going on?
Well, some of the crews had become, some of the air crews had become badly affected by the tropical conditions and were suffering sort of heat exhaustion. And there were also some replacement aircraft for ones that had either been damaged or we'd managed to get a better type of Avenger than the ones we'd got.
But so this is the Avenger Mark II?
Yes, this is the Avenger Mark II. We were back in Marnus for about a week, and we then left there on the 25th of June to join up with the main British Pacific Fleet, which had left Sydney with Admiral Vine in charge of the aircraft carrier group. And we actually headed south from Marnus, and we should say as well that the Indefatigable, which was the sister ship to the Implacable, had been delayed in Sydney. So there were the two fleet carriers, the Formidable and the Victorious, and Vine by this time had put his flag on him, Formidable, and we were to rendezvous with them, and the Indefatigable would join us later to make up the four fleet carriers that form part of the British Pacific Fleet. We had, in fact, just joined up with the Formidable and Victorious when, on the early part of July, the Implacable suddenly developed severe vibrations, you know, and we had to actually stop the ship. And the chief engineer officer informed us that one of the four main thrust blocks had melted, which was a fairly serious situation, and the nearest place that we could get this fixed was either to go all the way back to Sydney, which was the nearest place with the dry dock and so on necessary to do it, or we had to repair this main thrust block at sea. And the mere fact that the one of these propellers, which were, I think, something like 20 feet in diameter, was not turning, the drag on it, as you can imagine, was quite considerable, and the whole ship was really vibrating. And the chief engineer officer, who was a commander, Holt Wilson, decided that they would endeavour to repair this thrust block at sea. And his crew worked in what were really horrendous conditions with heat and everything else. And after about a week, they did actually repair this thing, and we were able to proceed with all four propellers working, which would enable us to get the required 30 degree knots over the flight deck for taking off and landing on. The other problem was, of course, that if we'd have had to go back to Sydney, only the Formidable and the Victorious would have joined the main American 7th Fleet off Japan, which wouldn't have done the Royal Navy, wouldn't have made them look in very good light with only two fleet carriers, as opposed to there, I think they got something like 20. Anyway, we did get the thing going, and we did join up. We got our first sight of the American fleet.
Now, what did it look like? How big was it?
Well, they were in three different groups, the American fleet. It was under Admiral Halsey, who you probably know about, and they were in three separate groups with a number of fleet carriers in each group, along with all these other ships. And the British Pacific Fleet was to take up its station on the northerly side of the three American groups. So that I think I'm right in saying that the American groups were capable of putting 1,200 aircraft in the air for these strikes. And by the time the Indefatigable joined us, which joined us later on in July, we could put about 250 aircraft in the air for these strikes. So you're talking about between 1,400 and 1,500 aircraft that were available to do these strikes on the Japanese mainland. There was another incident I think I ought to record after we joined up with Formidable and Victorious. On the 11th of July, 8-8 squadron, my squadron, we did pretty well all the night flying in the British Pacific Fleet. And I was detailed...
Before we go on to the story, what was this night flying role? What were you doing at night?
Well, it was an exercise called a Shadex. Now, I don't know whether I can remember what the Shadex meant, but the object of the exercise was that I was to take off the Implacable with some flares, and some of the Hellcats, which are, again is a Grumman aircraft fighter bomber, were taking off the Formidable. And I was to drop these flares for them to do a night exercise. I think, I don't know exactly what it was, but I duly took off the Implacable. It was a fairly dark night, and I got an observer and an air gunner with me. And we went off, and I dropped these flares for these Hellcats. And I'm pleased to say my... observer, a chap named Ray Milton Hind, who was not my regular observer, found the fleet for me again. But I could see the masthead lights on ships beneath me, but it was impossible to identify which of the ships was an aircraft carrier. And suddenly, out of the gloom, an Aldis lamp flashed a green C, which is Dadi Dadi, in Morse code, and that meant join the landing circuit. So I headed for this Aldis lamp, and I could make out the dim lines of an aircraft carrier. So I did my landing circuit, which was to proceed up the starboard side of the ship for about half a mile, do a 180 degree turn, and then come on the downwind leg. And I should mention here that night flying from aircraft carriers is a bit difficult, and there are different forms of lighting that they use on the deck of an aircraft carrier. Our commander flying, who's a chap named Charles Evans, very famous Fleet Air on fighter pilot in the early part of the war, who was now our commander flying, he opted for what he called the minimum of night deck landing, which is just two rows of cat's eyes. Another form of lighting was called sunlight, where they sort of shone floodlights down onto the deck and let the whole deck up. Anyway, I proceeded on the downwind leg of my landing circuit, and as I got level with the stern of the aircraft carrier, I started my turn into the deck, and quite suddenly the whole of the deck lit up with this sunlight lighting, and I thought, he's taking pity on me because I'm the only pilot flying off the ship tonight. And the batsman picked me up, and I made what I think was probably the best night deck landing in the whole of my flying career. The problem was, as soon as I landed on, I looked out of the starboard side of my aircraft and saw a gantry arrangement on the starboard side of the ship, and I thought, well, we haven't got one of those in Implacable, so I realised I was on the wrong ship. But I could also see that there was a deck park of aircraft forward of the barrier, so it wasn't going to be possible for me to take off again. Anyway, the deck handling crew taxied me forward, and they lowered the barrier, and I went forward of the barrier, stopped the aircraft, and we all got out. And a chief petty officer came up to me and said, the captain would like to see you on the bridge, sir, you see. So I went up to the bridge, and the captain was there. I can't remember his name now. But
what ship was it?
This was the Formidable, which was Vian's flagship, of course. And he said, very glad to have you aboard, my boy. That was a very good landing. And I said, thank you very much, sir. And he said, as you've probably seen, there is a deck part forward, so you can't take off again tonight. I've informed Implacable that you're here, and we'll make arrangements for you to go back to Implacable tomorrow morning sometime. And I saluted him, said, thank you very much, sir. And they provided me with a very nice cabin, a lieutenant commander's cabin, actually. And I was only a sub-lieutenant, of course. We'd got a telephone in it and everything else. And I eventually got a phone call on this phone to say, we've arranged with Implacable that you will take off at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning and fly back to Implacable. And I said, thank you very much, sir. And we had a couple of drinks in the boardroom, myself and the observer who was with me that night. And I went back to the cabin, and I was woken up at about 7:30. Had a bit of breakfast. They got my went up on the deck, and they got my aircraft there, all ready for takeoff, and we climbed aboard. And of course, as I say, by this time we joined the rest of the British Pacific Fleet. And what you can't do in these sort of circumstances is one ship or two ships can't turn into wind and leave the rest of the fleet steaming straight ahead. So at a signal, the whole of the British Pacific Fleet, which was one battleship, three aircraft carriers at that stage, about five cruisers and about 10 or a dozen destroyers, all turned into wind. And I was given the signal to take off, and I flew what was probably about half a mile back to Implacable and landed on the batsman. Of course, it was daylight now, and the batsman picked me up and I landed on, and a lot of the lads from my squadron were all there on what was called Goofers Gallery, cheering me on, good old Bim, you know. And suddenly, over the tannoy, Charles Evans, Commander Flying, said, send that pilot up to me, you see. So I proceeded up to the island, up to the Commander Flying's position, and his opening words were, what the effing hell do you think you were doing? You see, and I said, well, sir, I thought the Formidable was the Implacable. And it wasn't until I landed on that I realised my error. And he told me not to talk such effing rubbish and to report back at 10 o'clock with my CO. my immediate reaction after that was to think, well, that's me demoted down to petty officer pilot, and that's it, and that will be me finished. Like, anyway, I went to see Alan Swanton, my CO, and I said, I'm sorry about what happened, sir, but I told him the story, and I said, I've got to report back to Charles Evans with you at 10 o'clock. Oh, he said, don't worry about it, my boy. He said, he's a bit liverish this morning. I'll go and have a word with him. And I never heard any more about it. Whether I was the only Fleet Air on pilot ever to land on the wrong ship, I don't know. But it was an incident that I shall never forget, certainly.
Now, was Charles Evans a commander?
He was a commander. He finished up, actually, as a Rear Admiral after the war.
What was he like? I mean, what do you remember? How good was he out?
He'd got a little ginger goatee beard. And actually, he was quite sociable with the aircrew on the ship. He was a flying man himself, unlike Vian, who had never flown off an aircraft carrier in his life, and he was in charge of the whole of the British Pacific Fleet aircraft carrier squadron, and yet he wasn't a flyer, whereas Charles Evans was, and he understood the problems that flying off aircraft carriers contained, and although he was a stickler for discipline and getting aircraft on and off the carrier in the quickest possible time, he was nevertheless a fair man, in my opinion. But he was the commander flying on the ship, and what he really said went, and that was the end of it. And anyway,
did you have any contact with Vian?
The only contact we had with Vian was he flew on board the Implacable one day as a passenger in a Firefly, and we all had to be assembled in the wardroom in our number one whites, and I think one of his first comments was, why aren't these officers wearing their wings? And if he'd have known, when you're sort of in action and so on, you don't wear your wings. And he should have known that. And he, as I say, I don't think he really understood what flying from aircraft carriers was all about. I know he got a very distinguished war record, but certainly some of the commanding officers of the squadrons on Implacable were, to say the least, not impressed with his attitude towards flying types, particularly those who were RMVR.
Now, did you have much contact with your ground crew? Oh, not ground crew, it's the wrong crew, but you know.
Well,
what
yeah,
I mean.
There were ground crew, yes.
Well, what was the composition of your team, and what did you have to do?
I had an engine fitter and an airframe fitter. My airframe fitter was a chap named Frank Farrandon, who, funnily enough, came from Leicester, the same as I did. And the engine fitter was a chap named Brown, who was a Londoner. But I always maintained that one of the main reasons that I survived the war was the fact that those two chaps kept my aircraft in a condition where it was, I was confident that it would get me back onto the ship again. And I had a very good relationship with my two fitters, the airframe and engine fitters. And
did you have an armourer as well, who did sort of dealt with the guns?
Well, yes, we did. Now, I can't remember whether there were three in my ground crew or whether the armourer dealt with a number of aircraft, because the armourer was mainly concerned with loading up of the bombs, the 400-500-pound bombs we carried, and reloading the 2.5 machine guns I had in the wing. I can't remember whether he was also responsible for looking after the air gunners' guns, which were in a little turret at the back of the canopy. Whether that was the air gunners' main responsibility, I honestly can't remember now.
Now, what was this night fight? I mean, you've told me about the night fight where we were dropping flares for an exercise, but you said you were responsible. Your unit, your squadron, was responsible for all the night flying. What do you mean by that? What night flying was there to do?
Well, of course, we did this night strike on the truck islands, and it was done purely by Avengers. And that, in fact, was the first night strike by the Royal Navy in the as part of the operations against Japan. That first strike at night on the truck islands was carried out by 828 Squadron, and I'm reliably informed that that was the first night strike ever from the British Pacific Fleet. We didn't actually do any night strikes on the Japanese mainland, but
if there had been, you'd have done them.
We would have done.
So what were you doing? Any flying when you first joined the American fleet?
Yes, we were then briefed to do our first strikes on Japan, and we were to attack. Our first strike was to attack an airfield called Tokushima.
Yeah, that's spelt
T O K U S H I M A, Tokushima.
And whereabouts in Japan?
That was on the island of Honshu. It was quite near the coast. And
what date was this scheduled for?
This was now then. Let me. My first strike.
It was what date?
My first strike on Tokushima Airfield was on the 24th of July.
Now, was there any? This was a day attack.
This was a day attack. In fact, some of the aircraft, the Fireflies and the Seafires, had done a strike on the Japanese mainland a few days before that. In fact, there was always some argument in the British Pacific Fleet as to whether the Fireflies from Implacable, or I think it was the Corsairs from one of the other carriers, either the Formidable or the Victorious, who were the first aircraft over the Japanese mainland.
Now,
first British Pacific Fleet aircraft.
But you wouldn't, I presume, know. I mean,
well, no.
What do you remember of this, the briefing for Tokushima? Anything special about it?
Well, it was the first, apart from the truck island things, this was the first briefing we'd had to attack the Japanese mainland.
What did it tell you then?
The other thing I should mention, after the truck island raids, although we all had observers and air gunners in the Avengers, after the truck raids, unless you were a flight leader, they dispensed with the observers from the rest of the aircraft. So only the flight leaders had an observer. So obviously one of the problems when you were going to do a strike on the Japanese mainland was to get back to the ship and find it. And without an observer, that could have been difficult. But the part of the briefing was that we were taken by our flight leaders, as it were, to the airfield. Their observers did the navigating. And we were then told that there would be a rendezvous point, which we were shown on the map, where we would reform after this strike. And I remember we took off. I think there were...
Now, anything else about the briefing? Anything else they told you?
Well, they told us about the number of Japanese fighters that were available who might attack us, and about the anti-aircraft fire that we were likely to expect. And so, you know, I viewed the whole thing with a little bit of trepidation. I mean, the truck raids were, there were no Japanese aircraft available to attack our formations, but this was a whole different ball game. All of a sudden, we were attacking the homeland of Japan, and we were to expect rather more resistance than we'd experience on the truck islands.
So you're a bit nervous.
Bit nervous, and we took off. I can't remember what time of day it was. Fairly early in the morning, I think. We had a very early breakfast and briefing, and I was flying number two to my flight leader, who was a Lieutenant RMVR Clifford Wearden, and we formed up, and of course we got, by this time of course, fighter cover from the sea fires on Implacable, because following the truck island raids, they had managed to get hold of a number of these torpedo petrol tanks, which they adapted to put underneath the sea fires between the fuselage and the undercarriage, and this enabled them to stay in the air for about 3.5 hours. Whereas the Avenger could stop in the air for about 6 hours. But it did mean that we would have fighter cover for the whole of the strike on Japan and back to the ship. So we took off, and we found the airfield or my
anything
flight.
About the trip out then? Anything about the flight there?
It was basically flying information.
How many were there in the flight format? Were you flying as a flight, or where was the rest of the squadron?
There were three different flights. The CO was leading one flight. The senior pilot, Reg Elliott, was leading the second flight, and Clifford Wearden. We were given names for these flights. The CO's flight was Gold Flight. The senior pilot's flight was called the Silver Flight, and for some reason Lieutenant Worden's flight was called Coco, K-O-K-O. Why it wasn't Bronze or Brass or I don't know, but it was Coco. And so we formed up, and we flew information towards Tokushima Airfield, and